Not an Evil Robot Overlord, a Stargate Atlantis fan fiction by Wonky Elk, read by Tasmi, rated teen, relationship Rodney John. Additional tags: fluff and humor, pre-slash, friendship, red dwarf references, light angst. John Shepherd had experienced quite a number of surreal moments in his life, most of which he'd simply accepted and plowed right on through with a shrug and a quip, saving his private internal freakouts for later. But his best friend getting arrested on charges of conspiring to overthrow Atlantis with an evil robot army was one of those occasions when his attempts to control his shock and agitation ended up being about as effective as a T-Rex trying to hide behind a lamppost. John was fully aware, though, that he couldn't do Rodney any good by being removed from the investigation, so he had accepted Ronan dragging him off by the scruff of his neck for a long, exhausting run, which gave him the time to rebuild his casual facade and outward objectivity, while inwardly making a detailed list of plans and backup plans in case of a conviction to steal a puddle jumper, snatch away Rodney from his prison cell, and go on the lam with him until either his name was cleared of what must surely be some bizarre and complicated misunderstanding, or John was cured of whatever this feeling was, which decimated his critical thinking skills whenever he was in Rodney's dangerously magnetic orbit. Part of him was bowled over by the sheer magnitude of what he was prepared to throw away for the sake of a single obnoxious astrophysicist who was at least three quarters ego and five quarters frustrating. Yes, John was extremely good at math. No, he did not want to change his answer. The rest of him was mostly just jumping up and down and squealing, "Road trip!" Rodney would never have noticed them if he hadn't been so goddamn tired, which wasn't his fault, whatever Carson liked to imply, with his narrowed eyes and frustrated concern and a complete lack of that soft, sweet bedside manner he used for literally everyone not named Rodney McKay. Rodney liked his bed, and he would gladly spend a whole lot more time in it, belly down and limbs sprawled out in bed, hugging unconscious bliss, if it wasn't for the fact that Atlantis had turned out to be just a little bit, well, death-trappy. Which wasn't entirely a surprise, of course. Half of the briefing for the expedition had been various ways of saying, might as well kiss your sweet ass goodbye. But it hadn't taken long to realize that the expedition really hadn't been ready for quite this level of, oh crap, what the hell's gone wrong this time? They were understaffed, laughably under-equipped, and increasingly demoralized. The whole life-sucking vampires thing having, not surprisingly, knocked them for a collective loop. And almost every time they got everything halfway under control and Rodney finally felt justified in crawling under his duvet for a moment and sticking a metaphorical finger up at the waking world, there seemed to be an exciting new crisis popping up, one which was flatteringly determined to make his personal acquaintance, accepting no substitutes. This had led to a few side effects. Involuntary desk naps, for example. The way that color sometimes seemed to leach right out of the world and leave it both looking and feeling like a bruise, if you were to put the noir air on it and a mild Gaussian blur. And, most saliently to his current predicament, it left him with those persistent sort of flickers at the edge of his vision, which gave the impression that up there being something constantly lurking just out of sight. Which was, yes, extremely creepy and disturbing for the first week or so, but after a reasonable period of consistently not being jump scared by a wraith, or a stalker, or some eldritch being with nothing better to do than torment tired geniuses from beyond the veil, it became almost like having a pet. Something friendly and companionable, and more crucially, absolutely no bother whatsoever. It didn't need fixing, or berating, or entertaining. It didn't want reports or to make demands or accusations. It was just there. Or rather, very much not there. But Ronnie had always had a complicated relationship with hallucinations, and he supposed that an alien city in a far-flung galaxy was not the sort of place which readily helped you get that sort of thing all straightened out. And if he hadn't become so very used to how the not-things, which he almost saw, worked, then he wouldn't have noticed when the flicker of comfortably dismissible nothing was suddenly, actually, something. And once the spell was broken, he couldn't stop seeing them. No, of course it wasn't magic, Rodney snapped at his interrogators with a scorn that John could almost kiss for its grounding familiarity, a lifeline in the sea of surrealism where Rodney was grumpily sat in handcuffs. Cuffs, seriously? It's standard security procedure, Ronnie, especially when someone tries to become an evil overlord. And John was trying to be stern and impartial while feeling on entirely the wrong side of the room. It was just the way that this particular cloaking device worked. It wasn't an optical illusion, but a mental one. Quite a remarkable piece of technology, actually. Though flawed, of course. It relies on you assuming that a place like Atlantis would not be crawling with frankly ridiculous and cartoonish scutterbots, and as soon as you have any reason to doubt that assumption, his hands, even though restrained, still managed to describe, quite effectively, the extent to which the illusion was then blown. And before I could actually contact anyone about it, which, believe me, was very much next on my to-do list, about 100 of them grabbed me and dragged me right through the wall. Ronnie had been nearly killed a whole lot more times than he was comfortable acknowledging to himself, even if his talks with Kate Heitmeyer, which he refused to think of as therapy, more a sort of friendly and formal chat situation with a schedule and a time limit and friendly and formal notes on his permanent medical records. But this, he was pretty sure, was the most embarrassing peril so far. He was being kidnapped by a sort of carpet of robots, but not the cool type of robots, which made you gasp in awe at their gleaming technological excellence, glowing eyes, and smooth metallic swagger, even as they lasered you to death. No, these were dumpy little things, with a body like a beaten-up lawnmower and a jointed arm, or neck, which led to a single grabby claw, serving as either hand or head or both. They were improbable. They were impractical. They were goofy. They were the very antithesis of elegant ancient technology. They were, getting really overfamiliar with his hindquarters. Ronnie wriggled angrily out of their grasp and executed a neat and dignified scrabble to his feet. The robot things let him go without fuss, but then lost any points that they'd gained for good behavior by circling him and craning their claw heads in a way which made him feel horribly and unfavorably assessed. Then, as if on signal, they all began squeaking and chirping at him loudly and incomprehensibly, which was extremely frustrating. How was he to determine from that whether this was some bizarrely low-budget alien invasion, a plea for help, or simply his own tendency toward hallucinations gone wildly out of hand, possibly due to this morning's consumption of an out-of-date Twinkie? Which he couldn't be blamed for. There was a strictly limited allocated Twinkie space on the Daedalus, and when he found 3/4 of a bar which had gotten lodged under his couch cushion, somehow, and forgotten, what was he supposed to do? Not fall on the thing and devour it, like slightly fluffy manna from the gods? Ignoring the noise for now, Rodney took the opportunity for a more careful look around at the room to which he'd been taken. Straight through a solid wall, which was one of the many things he was currently frantically processing, though hardly the immediate priority. It was huge, dimly lit, and largely empty, but the floor was mostly covered in strange crystal formations at regular intervals. Rodney liked to think that he would have come to the conclusion that these were robot charging stations, even if there hadn't been a few dormant robots in the corner, each parked comfortably over a crystal which was emitting a low but visible glow from underneath, their claw arms neatly folded down and tucked like a swan at rest. Which immediately suggested a couple of things. One, that these robots were almost certainly an integral part of Atlantis. Two, that there were probably a whole lot more of them than the comparative handful currently surrounding him. A lot more questions arose from these points, but while he was asking them, trying to make himself heard over the cacophony of urgent mechanical noises, one of the robots snuck up from behind him, grabbed him by the arm, and did something. It was like being struck by lightning. If the lightning was also a cobra, and the cobra was also a vodka sour with rocks in it. Rodney scowled at the memory, as if that would make it scurry far away and never come back. Which all seems rather unnecessary for what amounted to a crude translation interface. Apparently the usual gate translation technology doesn't extend to scutters. The limitations are really fascinating, actually. Rodney had this little extra spark about him whenever he was imparting information that he personally found really interesting. An enthusiasm which positively shone through him like he'd swallowed an entire star. It was unbalancing. Stick to the point, McKay. Rodney rolled his eyes but resumed his story and the scowl. John definitely did not feel a sense of loss. When Rodney woke up, he felt like he'd been through a meat grinder and then stuck back together again with duct tape, super glue, and possibly a nail gun? Also, was there some sort of water torture going on? He blinked his eyes open in increasing panic to find a group of robots hovering over him, somehow managing to convey concern with their claw faces. One of them was passing a wet flannel over his forehead with a little too much vigor. Somehow, though, he could tell that their intentions were good, even if the execution was less than ideal. Yes, yes, thank you. I think I'm sufficiently watered now. Rodney sat up gingerly and blinked around at his captors while he waited for his bout of dizziness to pass. Oddly, his fear was disappearing just as quickly. The robots were bizarrely expressive, despite their limitations of feature, and Rodney's nostalgic fondness for the clunky special effects of the films and shows that he had once hoovered up as a child seemed to be spilling over to them entirely against his will. The robot, which had been assiduously dampening him, cocked his claw at an angle and gave an inquiring beep. No harm intended. Secrecy protocols executed. Medical help required. Y/N. And yes, obviously medical help was required. He'd been snatched and shoved through a wall and zapped in some deeply unpleasant manner, and who knew how many brain cells he just lost just from fright alone. Except that while he still had a lingering sense of being minced and nailed, it was more of an unpleasant background noise than anything actively endangering his life. And while asking for medical help might mean that they returned him to Carson, it seemed far more likely that the robots would try their hands at first aid themselves. Rodney eyed the sea of earnest claws and decided that he really didn't want to risk it. No, I'm surprisingly okay given the whole kidnapping thing and whatever the hell you just did to me. Rodney glowered at the robots, but that was only really an afterthought. He could already tell from their intentions were not essentially malicious, despite everything. And he had suddenly realized that he was sensing the robots and Atlantis itself in a whole new and intriguing way, which he was looking forward to exploring properly. Rodney certainly wasn't averse to getting a personal upgrade, like the ATA gene therapy. It would just have been preferable to have a choice in the matter. Emergency communications required. Regrets expressed. Well, apology accepted, I suppose. Rodney got to his feet, did a quick dizziness check. All good, and then turned to the robots, his brain rapidly cycling through a laundry list of pertinent questions, his habit of knee-jerk longaria, and the good old standby of running like hell before it treacherously bowed to the thought, what would Shepard do? Okay, so he waved a hand to economically cover the whole room and situation all in one. What the hell? The robot in charge, or so Rodney presumed, word forwards, settled into a comfortable position and began. What the hell? Rodney cast a glance at John with a muttered, ha, nailed it, for some reason. Yes, yes, I know. It doesn't appear to make sense at first, but... No kidding, John shared a troubled glance with Elizabeth, then Ronan and Tayla, who were sitting in on the initial questioning for moral support. Whether for Rodney or John and Elizabeth or all of them, John wasn't quite sure. But maybe if you all just listen for a moment, it will. Rodney paused and then dropped his face into his cuffed hands in despair. No, you're right. It doesn't make any sense. I'm going to get locked up forever, all because some ancient idiot made the decision to program their home and shining pinnacle of their technological prowess with a sense of embarrassment. Translating freely from the clip language of the Scudders, as they called themselves, the story went something like this. A city as large and busy as Atlantis required a high level of maintenance, and not just from a technological aspect, which was handled by a highly trained team of engineers, but in terms of cleaning and minor repairs. This would usually have been handled by its own team, except that ever since Ascension had gotten hold of the ancients in a major way, there was a general feeling that tasks like scrubbing floors and cleaning toilets were antithetical to the process of becoming pure light. A few years ago, Rodney would have been smugly on their side with this one. These days, after some forcible changes to his worldview on what things and people were worthy of respect, and a few enlightening conversations with Tayla and others, sometimes with Styx, he was just as smugly against. It was decided to simply create a set of maintenance bots, which would quietly and efficiently do all the boring and tedious jobs while everyone else got on their life and escaping life, which was not at all a bad idea in and of itself, except that things predictably and almost immediately went wrong. The first batch of robots worked just fine for a couple of weeks before going all Sorcerer's Apprentice and cleaning with such excessive zeal that sections of Atlantis were flooded or rendered lethally slippery due to extreme polishing. And one major official was repeatedly mistaken for a section of floor and hovered almost to death. The next batch did exactly what they were supposed to, up until the point at which they gained full sentience and an urge to destroy their creators. Fortunately, they'd been fitted with a very firm off switch. The third batch, created after a long and exhaustive process to be perfect in every way, had an existential crisis 3 weeks in. Huddled together on the pier in a mass state of meditation and periodic mopping. And then, quite insultingly, ascended in mass, with no trouble at all. It was at this point when they had to decide to either just do it themselves, after all, or go with the last of the originally proposed designs, which had been immediately discarded by almost everyone in a gale of mocking laughter. The Scudders, as their designer pointed out, were the very opposite of terrifyingly lethal, too clumsy to get to deadly levels of cleaning efficiency, and too plain ridiculous in every way to achieve ascension. Plus, they would be very quick, easy, and cheap to build, which was an important consideration now that the robot budget had been drastically eaten into by the last three disasters. They were voted through out of sheer exhaustion, and to everyone's surprise, did a great job. No one quite knew how they actually managed all of the more intricate cleaning tasks or their impressive knack with plumbing, nor how they managed changing the bulbs. But Somehow it all worked, and Atlantis could function perfectly at last. Everything was harmony and light and happy, industrious little beeps, until Atlantis had had a few visitors to their great city. These had marveled at the technology, expressed appreciation for the decor and sense of light and space, and universally gawped, then sneered at the Scudders as if they were watching someone squirt ketchup all over a fine steak, or sketch a bushy mustache on the Mona Lisa. The ancients took to instructing the Scudders to make themselves scarce whenever visitors were around, and then, just whenever the ancients themselves were walking around, reassigning their cleaning schedules to the quietest times, except where strictly necessary, to avoid having to be confronted every day by the ugly ducklings inside their beautiful, graceful swan. A special section was cordoned off for the Scudders, charging and storage area, where they were comfortably out of sight and mind. Atlantis, being a semi-sentient city attuned to the motions of its inhabitants and perfectly capable of a mortified setting, quickly picked up on the distaste and accommodated it, allowing the Scudders the ability to phase through the walls and other solid objects at will, with or without any largest objects they might be carrying, such as cleaning tools or flailing astrophysicists, in order to do their jobs with far less risk of being noticed. It was the ancients who developed the technology which eventually made the Scudders functionally invisible through the sheer power of their denial. But it was Atlantis who was careful to rigidly maintain it. Over years and centuries and millennia, red-faced with horror at the idea that the new inhabitants might catch a glimpse of their secret shame. "So you're saying that you had to kidnap me just because Atlantis can't take the idea of anyone seeing a piece of less than graceful technology inside their walls?" The Scudders nodded with a hint of despondency, which hit Rodney squarely in his carefully hidden compassion. Great. That always got him in trouble. And he absolutely didn't empathize in any way with being considered the jarring note in an otherwise beautiful symphony. He didn't. Possible outcomes of widespread discovery: destruction of inhabitants, destruction of self, massive sulking fit under the ocean, duration 1 to 16,008 years, approximate. Rodney did not panic, if only because he was too busy freezing on the spot. "Okay, that's bad. That's very bad." He took a deep breath. "Widespread discovery. So wait, if I just don't mention you at all, one insignificant human in possession of secret equals uncomfortable but acceptable. Multiple humans in possession of secret equals error, system crash, query, kill them all." Rodney bit his tongue to prevent himself arguing against his own insignificance, though honestly, it hurt almost as bad as the zappy thing, and nodded. "Good. Right. Fine. Definitely keen to avoid any kill-them-all outcomes. Trust me, if you let me go, I won't speak a word of this." The Scudders inspected him dubiously. And hey, Rodney was damn good at keeping secrets, thank you. Like whole alien civilizations, for example, before nodding and giving him what he assumed was an attempt at a thumbs up, hampered by the lack of actual thumbs. He was carefully escorted out through the walls into a clear area and given a cheery wave goodbye. And that really should have been that. But of course, it wasn't. I mean, for a start, they didn't go back to being invisible again, not now that I knew they existed. Neither did they bother to keep out of my way, which meant that while most people were blissfully going about their day in peaceful obliviousness, I couldn't turn a corner without almost tripping over a Scudder or two, mopping the floors or dusting or doing one of the million other things which we had put down to unknown self-cleaning technology to be explored later when trying desperately just to survive is less of a priority. Not only that, but After a while, we got kind of chatty. I mean, I couldn't exactly pass up the chance to learn about ancient technology and the workings of Atlantis from the inside, and they obviously were keen to learn from a genius like myself. John raised an eyebrow and pointed it at Rodney like an arrow. It struck two, deflating him instantly. Fine, fine. They found me novel, confusing, and for some reason, hilarious, even when I was giving some extremely useful pointers on leadership. The point is that we got friendly, and that led to situations which, for a man of lesser wits, might have been somewhat difficult to explain. John exchanged another glance with the others. There had certainly been some incidents leading up to the rest, which had aroused some concerns. Their CSO having an earnest discussion with a wall about the feasibility of claw hockey, for example, and the way that he had a recent tendency to swerve around patches of empty air. Rodney's blustered explanations for these things had done the opposite of allaying those concerns. And while naturally I managed to handle these situations smoothly and without raising any suspicions, it did highlight the fact that it would be extremely easy for someone else to break through the illusion just as I did. And so, Rodney broke out his frequently used, "We are so very doomed" face, which adequately covered how very dire the consequences would be. Obviously, the safety of Atlantis and everyone on it couldn't be left hanging by such a thin and snappable thread, now that I knew. And maybe I also felt just a little bit. Look, the Scudders didn't exactly deserve to be shoved aside and ignored, like something disgraceful. When Rodney digressed this time on a 10-minute rant about mistreatment and skewed values and the Claw Hockey League, which he had, in fact, set up and which was apparently thriving, no one interrupted him. It was moments like this that John Shepherd stopped fighting the love he felt for Rodney, like some powerful, terrifying, maybe shameful thing which he couldn't accept, didn't deserve, and just allowed it to overwhelm him completely, basking in it as it lapped around him like light and flight and laughter and everything that mattered most in the world with extra sprinkles. Rodney finished abruptly with an awkward cough and a frown, like he'd suddenly remembered that his compassion was showing and needed to hastily cover it up with a towel of emotional modesty and the pointed pretense that, nope, that didn't just happen. So the only way to fix it was by talking to Atlantis itself. Rodney's new interface abilities were a little disappointing at first. They allowed him to talk to the Scudders and to have a better appreciation of Atlantis's general mood and a vague, indefinable sense of connection, without allowing him to plug his mind directly into the system or make any greater headway with things like the database than he'd managed before. But with a little practice, he discovered he could in fact tune into Atlantis's wavelength with a greater and greater accuracy. Atlantis was not a fully sentient city. That had been deemed an irresponsible security risk, having something which was so very much in control of every aspect of your life, perfectly able to make independent decisions such as, "I think you don't deserve it anymore," seemed like an unwise move at best. But they had still built in a certain level of awareness and limited autonomy to make the interface easier to use and to save on effort. Somewhere in the mix, the ability to react to human emotions had been added, along with, possibly accidentally, the ability to feel them, or at least to act under certain circumstances on an emotional basis, rather than a purely logical one, sometimes confusing the two. And at some point, the ability to make a few rather sweeping, independent decisions had crept in after all, except not necessarily with any reasoned and rational backing. Having a conversation with Atlantis was not as comparatively straightforward as talking to the Scudders, but it wasn't impossible to communicate in a more limited fashion, Rodney had been making a decent amount of headway in his arguments when events escalated. Rodney's scowl got even deeper as he got to the crunch point of this whole mess, and John absolutely did not want to smooch the lines away with his tender, loving fingertips and the butterfly brush of his lips, because that would be lame. Yeah, that was what he was going with. Which was where Major Lorne came into it, recklessly endangering Atlantis through the medium of watercolors. Lorne, Rodney found out later, had been doing a series of studies of Atlantis in his spare time. Sketches, mostly, but also a few full-color efforts to practice his painting skills. Maybe it was his sheer and absolute focus, or his unerring artistic eye, or maybe there was just some ill-timed glitch in the invisibility shield. Whatever the reason, on the last painting that Lorne made, he found, when he'd finished, that he'd managed to add in an odd, squat, robotic figure without really noticing, which he might just have put down to some sort of unconscious whimsy if the next sketch he made hadn't also got one of those robot figures in. Rodney had happened to be passing just as Lorne frowned at the sketch and looked up sharply to see the scutter very much there, in person, and looking as scared as a clunkily made robot without a face could manage. Several things happened at once. Lorne was lunged at by the panicking scutter, evaded it neatly with a very graceful tuck and roll, and drew his gun. Alarms blared in anguish all over the city, and Rodney felt the weight of utter humiliation hitting him, full force, from a wildly out-of-control Atlantis, clearly about to make some very poor life choices. Fortunately, he hadn't just been relying on his skills at communication and gentle persuasion, just because he'd all but worn out the word genius until it was tattered and threadbare and looked on with scorn whenever he waved it like a flag, didn't mean that he wasn't actually one. Not to mention that he tended to assume the worst and plan accordingly. Emergency protocols, Operation Desperate Freaking Measures, go, go, go! When he wasn't offering his words of wisdom to the Scudders, organizing sporting events, and hearing all the latest gossip about who had been entwining cables with whom, Rodney had been working on a plan of action with them, just in case the truth about the whole thing came out before Atlantis was in a proper frame of mind to accept the situation and be a lot more chill about it. Fortunately, his increasing control of the scutter supplied interface powers, which he could now use to communicate with all of them at once, along with his ATA gene and general technological brilliance, gave him a method to potentially do something about it. Unfortunately, it involved actions which looked, on the face of it, a little bit sabotage-y. Especially when the whole psychic cloak thing broke down entirely and everyone could see that Atlantis was suddenly and inexplicably covered in strange and alarming robots, which were swooping about and messing with Atlantis's system, yanking out cables, messing with crystals, and snatching up and disappearing people who tried to interfere. All of which they were doing under the explicit command of one Rodney McKay, who was also tapping wildly away at the consoles, shutting down systems without explanation. Look, he didn't exactly have time for a PowerPoint presentation on why the current situation was very, very bad. And swearing Atlantis in 13 different languages, while ringed by a dedicated circle of scutters who fought off anyone who tried to stop him and beeped with an impressive ferocity fully worthy of evil minion status. The whole affair didn't last more than a few very crowded minutes before the alarm stopped and Atlantis's destructive instincts had been thwarted and then settled into a sort of grudging agreement to meditate for a while on the topic of overreaction before taking further steps. Rodney stepped away with relief. At which point, John's security forces broke through and he was tackled to the ground with what, in Rodney's opinion, was entirely unwarranted enthusiasm. Luckily, I'd already given the signal to stand down by then and ordered the Scudders to use their phasing abilities to evade capture and hide. It seemed pretty likely, otherwise, that they would be assumed hostile and damaged or destroyed before I could manage an explanation. Rodney narrowed his eyes at John, tried and failed to cross his arms, and then made a rather endearing attempt to pretend that he completely remembered about the whole handcuffs thing and was just stretching, actually. Which I would have given a lot earlier if certain people hadn't let their men put me in the infirmary. Carson had not seemed overly worried about Rodney's injuries. Some mild bruising, and he clearly hadn't slept properly for a while, so I gave the lad a few hours' nap. And while John himself had been rather humiliatingly tangled up in Scudders at the time and really had nothing to do with it, he felt obliged to defend his people anyway. They were just doing their jobs, Rodney. As far as they could tell, you and your robot army were being a clear and immediate threat to Atlantis. Think yourself lucky that they didn't just shoot you. John offered up his most deliberately annoying smirk to hide the immediate lurch in his guts at the thought. He had nightmares, very often, about Rodney dying, and he was pretty damn sure that this would be a new addition to the roster, his body racked with bullets in cinematic slow motion as he tried to gasp out his explanation to no avail. Rodney would probably end up dying in John's arms, as he usually did in those dreams. It didn't matter how often that had not happened in real life. Holland's death had left a scar inside him as deep as the Mariana Trench and just about as crushing. Now Rodney's death, that he might not actually survive, the pressure bearing down on him like an imploding sun and folding him, almost gratefully, into nothing at all. None of which meant that John was going to not mock him about this whole thing, obviously, now that everything seemed to be essentially cleared up. He resolutely refused to be disappointed that he wouldn't get to go do the whole fugitive road trip thing. And of course, assuming that Atlantis didn't revert back to the whole destroying them all thing, which, yeah, okay, that really needed to be addressed. But hey, what sort of friend would he be if he ignored the serious teasing potential in, remember that time you took over Atlantis with a horde of claw-mounted Roombas? It was surprisingly easy in the end, both to persuade Atlantis that the retro-look Scudders were beloved and valuable assets, which should be celebrated rather than stuffed away in a cupboard like the ratty dressing gown you never wore in front of strangers, and to get everyone on board with remaining on a city for which embarrassment could quite literally be terminal in a very broad and inclusive sense. After all, there was already so much in Atlantis and Pegasus in general that could kill them at any given moment. Anyone who couldn't deal with that tended to leave as soon as possible anyway. And everyone who chose to remain found that the benefits in staying on the most amazing city in the universe, not that Rodney was biased, outweighed the very considerable risks. Benefits which now included the newly inaugurated Scudder Olympics, a brainchild of Madge the Scudder, which already promised to be a highlight of the Atlantis calendar, and the joy of learning new things through his connection with Atlantis, including the fact that they shared the same taste in music, and that power efficiency could be actively improved through judicious use of a playlist which included the Star Wars theme song, an eclectic selection of classics, and certain 80s pop numbers which Rodney would never previously have admitted to liking, and knowing every single word, chord, and key change. But maybe it was time to reassess the things he genuinely needed to be ashamed of, versus the things which other people should be ashamed of looking down on and sneering at, as if it was any of their business. And because the particular procedure which Rodney had been subjected to make him understand the Scudders, turned out to have a 78% fatality rate, a fact which had sent Rodney running to the infirmary and refusing to leave until he had been certified healthy through every means available, some of them twice. Atlantis was relying largely on him these days for the help with emotional regulation, an outcome which had doomed written all over it in huge blocky letters and underlined twice. Thankfully, Rodney was friends with several people who were much better at that sort of thing than he was, and also with Shepard, who very much wasn't, but who improved his mood and life somehow just by existing. In fact, some days Rodney even thought, but no, he was reading too much into things. Shepard was too much of a Kirk, dashing, handsome, causing most of the women he met to swoon into his arms, almost before he could say hello, to even think of. In short, he was being ridiculous. Quite ridiculous. And did it matter anyway, when what he really wanted most from John Shepard was exactly what he had? Someone he would do anything for, and who would do the same in exchange. Someone who had seen the best and worst of him and had stuck by him anyway, through everything the universe could throw at them. Someone he could talk to sincerely when he really, truly needed to, and listen in return. And most importantly, of course, someone with whom he could spend the whole of mandatory break day unselfconsciously playing evil robot overlords with. Nothing said love deeper or louder than that. The end.